Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 90, titled A Loving Look of Compassion.
Then finally, there was in these four themes that we're doing in the basic Buddhism. Fourth one is that any place I get as an egocentric person, a being, entity, will be unsatisfactory. So this is the sort of larger theme of the suffering of the samsara, meaning that the basic way of being, of where it's me versus the world, however I can be a billionaire, a 100 billionaire, you know, and still it's hopeless, it's misery. And it involves meditating to see that, the situation of being closed in on oneself and concerned primarily for oneself, and therefore with a deep inner sense of aloneness, ultimately. Die, because one does die by oneself. And you know, identifying so much as one's body and one's whatever, that however you magnify that situation. And in the Buddhist worldview, it's complicated because you have to visualize the suffering of the gods, you know, because they do think there are angels and gods. They don't think there's one creator. That is a silly person. But they think it's silly. But although they do understand how it works, it can serve for some people. And especially the Dalai Lama has been especially good about that. But philosophically, they think it's unscientific and irrational. But they still do think there are these other kinds of beings. And yet even those beings, when they're in some heaven, it's their heaven, they're alone in that heaven. They're apart from the hell, and they're leaving some other beings out there in hell. It's still an inadequate way to be. It's a suffering, fundamentally. They can have a lot of pleasure, but it comes to an end. And when it comes to an end, and they're addicted to a high level of pleasure, it's especially painful. So there's an equal and opposite amount of pain. And that's a big meditation. So those four things, preciousness of life, immediacy of death, skillful causation of interaction with the world, and also in one's mind, because that's a terrible thing about Buddhism. Why they all want to meditate all the time, it's really quite terrible. Because your mind is evolutionary. So you have a murderous thought. You didn't do anything. You were smiling. You were nice. But you had like, oh, I wish that guy would get bombed or something. You have that thought. That's like a killing act. Because you killed them in your mind. Or you have a greedy thing in your mind. Like poor old Jimmy Carter had in Playboy. Then you have a lustful thought in your mind. Then your mind has committed that. And that, because the mind shapes the way the body becomes, it shapes the quality of life. It's the most powerful, it's like the essential key to how life is the mind. So then they want to clean up the mind, you know. They don't want to leave the mind with seething unconscious. They have to become conscious of the whole thing and clean it up. So therefore they make a lot of meditational institutions. They learn to deal with their mind. You know, it becomes a big thing in their education. Like they would never go through 16 years of grade school, high school, and college without learning absolutely how to meditate and develop high level of concentration and memory and so forth. They would really increase those powers of intelligence. I mean, that would not be education if you didn't do that. You just thought education was getting information. That's not education in those civilized societies. That's a minor part of it. Okay, so those three. Then if you go those four things, preciousness of yourself, immediacy of your death, skillfulness of how you live, and then the inadequacy of all self-centered states of being, you then develop what is called transcendent renunciation, which I consider the equivalent of compassion for yourself. You decide, you really stop being in denial about what makes you suffer. You stop being in denial about the fact that your drivenness to be a big success, your drivenness to accumulate wealth, your drivenness to have a lot of relationships, your drivenness to be famous, your drivenness to whatever it is, you're punishing yourself with all of those things, and none of those things are going to be lasting achievements. They will all become dust. And so you suddenly say, wait a minute, I'm not driving myself to open my being to become more blissful, to become more aware of reality, to evolve. That's really what I should be doing good to myself to start with, and caring for myself at that deeper evolutionary level. Instead, I'm pushing myself in all these professions and all these mundane things, and having mercilessly driving myself like I'm my own slave of my ambitions. And then you get compassion for yourself. And then that's the place where you can find the seed of true compassion for others. Not just sentimental, oh, the poor dears. Oh, the poor thing, if only they were famous or rich or some other mundane thing, which wouldn't make them happy anyway. You find compassion for yourself. Then you realize, and then when you get that kind of transcendent feeling, you begin to realize the transcendent purpose of your life, you budget your time very differently. You prioritize how you live very differently. It doesn't mean, of course, ideally you'd be in a society where people would just congratulate you if you just dropped out of every profession, everything, and you said, I'm going to just put my whole life energy into developing my heart, my soul, and I want free lunch, and I want a place to stay, and I want to be, you know, protected and taken care of by the larger group. And societies are structured like that, truly individualistic ones, where anyone can drop out and completely to be taken care of and be honored that they are seeking to become higher beings. And in a way, by seeking that, even they are lifting the quality of everybody's life, even those who are taking care of them, because they somehow haven't caught that ambition. So the transcendent renunciative ambition of compassion for, insight about compassion for yourself is very, very powerful. And it is the essence. Tibet, look at Tibet. Tibet had 6 million people in recent times, and 6,254 monastic educational institutions for 6 million people. 6,000, and the biggest ones had 10,000-12,000 monks, 4,000 nuns, etc. And when the Chinese, in the time of Hu Yaobang, after Gang of Four, when Deng was not paying attention and to his oppressive habits, and he let Hu Yaobang be nice to the Tibetans, they expected Tibetans to go out and start laundries and truck gardens and do business and get wealth because they had crushed their economy. But instead, Tibetans went out and started building monasteries and becoming monks and nuns and rebuilding Buddhas. Totally, because that's what life is about for them. Is not just building some statue to worship, but becoming a Buddha yourself. That's the purpose. It's finding your higher quality of being. But then when you feel that compassion for yourself and you feel really more free, and actually, ironically, a person who has that, they can live more effectively on the mundane level, because they're like a poker player who's a little detached from the victory, and they can bluff well. And they're kind of dropped out. They don't get quite so hung up on getting it, So they can be more effective in what they do for others or in life and work. Because they don't, in a little bit, they see it from it. They're able to take another perspective and not so completely driven. And then they look around and they see other people being driven from birth to death, just eating, sleeping, getting, and spending, and thinking that that's just what it is. And finding a little relief here and there, but basically misery. I had to park in front of a McDonald's the other day coming down to the city. Someone had to go to the bathroom in the car, and I was just parking there, and I just felt so sad for our people in our country. They're just so poisoned by the bad food and the bad medicine and the bad exercise, and they're like really, really sad. I mean, some couple hand in hand, they're so cute, and then they have legs and they have an upper torso, and then there's this huge thing here. And you can't even imagine who sewed that. What kind of pattern did they use? It's like an immense thing. The butt and the belly is like, it's I don't know, it looks like a balloon, like somebody pumped it up with, like, I don't know, nitrogen or something. And they just walk, you can see them walking right into the amputations, the diabetes, the grave, you can see it. And they're like, okay, let's get that Mac, we gotta go get that Big Mac. We're gonna get it now. That's it. That's what there is in life. Another Big Mac. So you see other beings like that and you feel compassion. Then you really feel compassion for them. But we don't feel a big compassion because we normally just have our family, yes, or someone we identify closely with, a teammate, or whatever, neighbor. But mostly they are strangers. So then there's this marvelous bunch of meditations that they teach, which is just amazing, where the everyone has been your mother, you know. The first one is what's called mother recognition. And you've already worked on your own infinite number of past lives in order to get to realize that you are this amazing thing, that you've now gotten to this point of life, this nexus of humanity, body, mind, incredible, sensitive, altruistic, totally deprogrammable and reprogrammable wetware that you are. You can completely be really great and really awful. You're in this amazing, amazing, transformable situation of humanity. And so you've already realized that, the vastness of your past life, and you've realized the vastness of everybody else's past life. And then you realize that we've all lived infinitely, and therefore everybody's been your mother. And after all, mom was the only one who agreed with you before you even knew it, that you were the only one for a little while. All too little. The mother's gold era. Hey, the mother's gold era. You're the one, you know. This thing, this face was looking at you. So then, this meditation enables you to find that face in every being. And looking at you that way, having looked at you that way, in that loving look, that look of total nurturing love and concern. Every being has that face. And it's amazing, that meditation. I think that neuroscientists, maybe they're going to find some neuron where the mother's face is remembered, and this meditation goes in and tweak that neuron. Please tweak, tweak, and suddenly everybody's mom, you know. Maybe. If that's what they hope. I don't think so. I think you have to condition yourself. You have to cultivate. It has to be built on this feeling of infinite connectedness and known disconnection, impossibility of disconnection. It has to be built on that feeling. And it's something that has to be learned. We have the capability of learning it. It isn't a mechanical gizmo. Anyway, when you do that, you build on that. Then you remember the kindness of these mothers, and you see their loving look, and then you feel totally grateful, and then you want to look at them that way. You want to be their mother, and you want to be so kind to them. You want them to be happy, like a mother wants her child to be happy. And then you see how beautiful they can all be, even those really fat ones. They're kind of cute, you know. They would roll in a certain way if they roll down the hill. And then you kind of, I know you don't want to go there, but somewhere. But you know, when you really love someone, they look beautiful to you, you know. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, you know, that kind of expression. When you loving them, meaning you want them to be happy, that means you kind of imagine them being happy. And any being, when they're really happy, they have beauty. They do. The face relaxes, the muscles, the tension in the jaw, and they just feel good. And they have a certain beauty. They do. Doesn't matter. The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Like, he's cute when he's happy. And that's called lovely love. Then compassion for them. Then you see they really are suffering, and you can't bear that, and you want to help them not suffer. And then you feel responsible for them. And then finally you just become totally altruistic. You decide, I'm going to live... You know, I and they are interconnected in one living body of life, and they are a much bigger sensitivity than mine in the aggregate, and so I'm going to live for the happiness of that vast aggregate of sensitivities. They're all going to be happy. I'm going to see to it. That's the bodhisattva, determination of the bodhisattva, the altruist, the determined, sort of promised, vowed altruist, fanatic altruist, if you will, absolute altruist. Although it won't be absolute until they have wisdom, actually. It will just be very strongly felt. So that's in the second whole bunch of paths. It's where then you expand that feeling of relief that you have from transcendence to embrace everybody else. And then there is a point there when you get what's called universal responsibility where you feel a little crazy. And that's a good thing when you get like, I can't stand everybody's suffering. And then what you do, the way you shift over is you say, well, then I'm going to become a Buddha for their sake. And then you open your mind to what a Buddha is and you realize there is a possibility of becoming pure light, a being of pure light. You already are a being of pure light, but there's a possibility of realizing that you're a being of pure light. And then when you are, you really join with the beings that have the ability to actually help all your mother beings. So you get less crazy, you know, and you calm yourself down by feeling connected to infinite numbers of already enlightened beings, because they are already infinite, because the past is infinite. There's no beginning to the universe. There are different rises and falls, but it's beginningless. Then you come to the final thing, which is the wisdom thing, and this is really critical. And the key to the wisdom is discovering, is said to be the wisdom. It's the antidote, the delusion of the absolute self. I'm the absolute thing here. The antidote to it is the wisdom of absolute selflessness. It's really fairly simple to express. It doesn't mean selflessness, Buddhist selflessness, doesn't mean that you don't have a self. Just like when you say Mother Teresa was selfless, you don't mean Mother Teresa doesn't have a relational self. You mean that she gives herself in action to the needs of others. So you mean she doesn't have a kind of self that she holds apart. In that case, that's a sort of ethical or moral way of using the word. But the technical way of using it in terms of identity in the Buddhist psychology and philosophy means that ourselves are relative, changeable processes. And the boundaries of them are arbitrary. And we're interconnected with each other. And there is no fixed, alienated, isolated self apart from all of that. And that the sense we have of this unchanging, essential witness core that never changes is a delusion. It's like something you imagine there's something around a corner, but when you get around the corner, it's not there. And then you imagine it's around the next corner, you keep going, it's not there. So there's a meditation, and the meditation on selflessness and the inquiry is it's not just some meditation, it's an inquiry. It's an inquiring type of meditation, and that meditation is actually not looking for selflessness, it's looking for the self. And where it discovers selflessness is in its failure to find the self, the way that it is imagined to be there. And so first there is a kind of an effort of critically imagining what it would be like if there, I mean, how is it that I feel that Bob Thurman is something separate from everything else and never changes? And so always Bob. And therefore, oh, when I die, oh, that's going to be terrible because I'll lose Bob, you see. But actually there is no such Bob Thurman. Bob Thurman is a name attached to an aggregate of body and mind in this life. And I've had other names even in this life, many. Dodo, I get called occasionally. and so that's very deep.